U.S. factory activity slowed.
Based on hitting a shareholder value as market capitalization.
A lot more global. So creating more programming not only for, you know, us here in the English-speaking U.S.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WGN.
And it's Friday. Welcome to the weekend. Friday afternoon here from the Allstate Skyline Studio. Steve Bertrand at WGN Radio. You heard the voice of Tom Gimbel there, the man behind LaSalle Network. He's going to talk about teamwork and working on a team at the office. And apparently he expects results. I don't know. I thought being on a team was all about fun. But Gimbel will be here to put the kibosh on that a little bit later in the program. We start on Fridays with the folks from Blue Sky Innovation, the Chicago Tribune, where they cover the tech world. Ben Meyerson is in the studio today. Ben, welcome back to the Biz Lunch.
Glad to be here, Steve.
Okay, so I've been doing this show a few years now, and I remember the big hubbub when the city council passed this new, or they expanded, right, the amusement tax. You'd always pay a tax on baseball tickets or things like that, but they expanded the amusement tax to basically cover the internet, right, or internet games?
The cloud tax, they called it.
The cloud tax,
yes.
Right. And so, but we're still fighting over it.
Yes.
It's been how long, 2 years, 3 years?
It was passed in 2015.
Okay.
Just recently, PlayStation started taxing its online service for the first time. Users got a little notification that popped up and said, hey, you're going to be paying an extra 9% on your what we charge you to play games online. And people were a little bit surprised by that.
Right.
But yeah, it's been something that has been charged by Spotify, Netflix, and Hulu for quite some time now, but it's gradually trickling out in different ways.
But as I look at this story, not everyone's paying it, right?
Yes.
Is it Netflix is fighting it? Apple's fighting it. They filed a suit in August.
Yes, Apple is fighting it, saying that it's illegal and discriminatory, and a group of users have sued, saying that it violates federal law, this particular tax. So it's still wrapped up in some controversy, but gradually more and more services are just ponying up and
This is like if there's an income tax or property tax increase and you decide to pay it and I decide not to, right? I decide to fight it in court and I just don't pay it.
You could have that interpretation. It's also I would think that it's personally a little bit more analogous to whether Amazon charges you sales tax on your purchase online. It's a little hard to nail down because of where they operate. But eventually they did start collecting it.
So PlayStation has, but the other, let's say Apple eventually loses in court. Are they going to be on the hook for a bunch of back taxes?
Hard to say. I'm not a lawyer here.
And if they're not, then and I've been paying it, I want a rebate, you know?
Yeah, I couldn't say. But it'll be interesting to see how this plays out, certainly. Like I said, I would say it's more analogous to when Amazon finally started collecting sales
tax.
Then
they just started collecting. They didn't say you owe us, 5% for the past 20 years or anything like that.
Yeah, but we'll see.
Hey, I'm interested in this. I just paused. I was going to call it fake meat. And the story basically is about what to call this new cell-based, or there is this lab-produced meat that is, I've heard about it for the last couple of years. Supposed to be very good. I'm a big meat guy. I love the meat. Meat is very environmental unfriendly, right? All of that takes up a lot of grazing, methane, and everything. So they're working on creating an alternative meat that's just like meat.
Yes.
Why are you laughing at me? What did I say?
I love the meat. I love the meat. There's a ring about that.
I hope no one recorded that. So we're going to have this faux meat, not tofu, but fake sort of meat, and they're trying to figure out what to call it, right?
Yes. I mean, so...
Clearly, they're not going to come to me after that.
Yes. Well, you seem like an expert here, so what can I say? So the principle here is that when you're eating cow meat, that cow is consuming lots of land. It's giving off lots of methane as that animal grows, and then eventually it takes a long time before you're actually able to kill and eat the animal.
Right.
But the principle here is that scientists are taking cells and essentially cloning and reproducing cells to create that meat without having to grow the whole animal, which some people say is more humane way of doing it. But yeah,
is this what was behind the Missouri law where you can't call imitation meat products meat? Remember that was last year?
I don't recall that specific thing, but there is definitely the debate here about the article that we have on our site here is what exactly to call it. And it's been a bit of a debate between scientists and producers, and some of the names that are, you know, that have been tossed out are lab grown, cell based, clean, in vitro, cultured, fake, artificial, synthetic, meat 2.0. But the one that the meat industry and some of the producers have come up, come to agree on is cell based, because
cell-based.
It's accurate. It doesn't say, you know, it doesn't
well, it doesn't make me want to, but it doesn't make me want to go to the restaurant. You know, I mean, this is the Chilean sea bass argument, right? It's got some ugly name, and they created the name Chilean sea bass to make it more attractive to consumers. That's kind of what we're doing here. They've got to brand this stuff, because if you're going to call it even cell based meat, that's not going to, people aren't going to be lining up for that.
Hard to say.
No, I'm telling you right now, Ben, they got to come up with a better name, because I want this to succeed.
Well, you're the meat guy.
I love the meat. I do. One more. Elon Musk wants our internet to come from outer space, and he wants a gazillion satellites up there.
Yes. So I don't know if any of you have friends who live in rural areas. It's real hard to get internet out there because you don't have the big cable lines out there. Pretty much just phones. And if they've got satellite TV, that you might know also that satellite internet has traditionally been terrible.
Right.
So what Elon Musk and a few other companies are trying to do is, instead of sending up, you know, just a handful of big satellites, big traditional satellites that you get internet from, they say might be more effective if you send up literally thousands of much smaller satellites that would provide satellite-based internet much faster.
And this is a bit of a space race, right? I mean, it's not just Musk. There are other companies doing it, and the one who's there first and succeeds most wins, I would imagine.
Theoretically. I mean, there's also a question of how many satellites is too many satellites.
Right, right.
There's space junk out there. You know, these things, as they orbit around the Earth, they're going thousands and thousands of miles an hour, and you know, if they were to run into something, I mean, that creates some debris that could be really dangerous.
Ben Meyerson, read more at ChicagoTribune.com. Thanks for coming by.
My pleasure.
It's 12:23. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust Chicago's Bank, here on 720 WGN. All right, when I was 9 years old, I was on a baseball team, the Mantino Pirates, and we had it was coached by Kenny Smith. Scott Smith, his son, was on the team. Cody Kirk was on the team. I was on the team. We were, I think, 3-13, and it was just the best team ever. And now on the phone line is Tom LaSalle, Tom Gimbel from LaSalle Network, to tell me that it wasn't a good team at all. Tom,
he always set it up well, Steve.
Tom wrote a piece recently about teamwork, and that's what we're kicking around a little bit, and which I like, because your point is teams shouldn't just be about getting, well, I don't know, maybe they should just be about getting along well and then accomplishing goals. What was your point here, Gimbel?
My point was that people will come in and interview for a job, and they'll say, I want to be part of a team. I'm a good team player. And the question you have to ask as the interviewer is, tell me about a time that the team really came together, that when you put in extra time, when you accomplish something beyond the job. Because, you know, if we use sports, which is our favorite analogy on the spot, Steve, there's teams that come in first place and there's teams that come in last place.
Yeah,
they're both teams,
yeah.
And the people who are on them both love being on teams, but some teams come together and do more. Some teams practice in the off season. Some teams speak up and tell people when their attitudes are bad, and that's not the team we want to have. And other teams lift people up, and they accomplish great things.
So when you're putting,
it's the same thing in the office.
When you're putting together a team as a boss, what is your idea behind that? I mean, is your idea simply that it's going to take more than one person to get this done, or we have to draw in people from different departments to get this done, or what is it that drives the team to you, the creation of a team?
The interesting thing about a work environment, there's a lot of interesting teams. You just take a traditional corporation. There's the accounting department team. There's the sales team. There's the marketing team. But then you have teams that are collaborative of certain people from each of those business units that work together on certain client engagements, where you need marketing, finance, and sales together, or you need somebody from legal or whatever it is. And then you have a mini team of players who don't usually work together. And so it's really trying to get who is the leader, number one. Every team has the alpha that's going to be in charge of it. Now, it's real easy in a self-sustained unit. If it's accounting or finance, it's the controller, the CFO. If it's sales, it's the VP of sales. But when you have a group that's together on a small project, somebody's got to step up and be in charge. And someone has to set the agenda.
And where it could be from any of those groups. You're saying
some, absolutely.
Right. So, are you behind this idea? I know there are companies that will do personality tests to figure out who should be the alpha in that. Do you think that's a good idea?
Yeah, it's the question is how long it takes for you to get the results. So a lot of companies, we're one of them, will have those results on individuals together. But then what you want to do, if you really want to dig into this, which is going to be a long-term project, is you can actually look at the profiles and work through the system and find out how the people actually work. Will these teams work well together? It's hard and it takes a lot of time, and most companies don't have the effort or the foresight to do that. And we're not always that great at it either, so I'm not pounding my chest on it. It's really it's a challenge to do.
Well, and it's also a moving target, I would think, right? Because it can't be perfectly examined, and projects change. You might be great for one project and not another or a task.
There's no doubt about that. And what you want to do is you realize that even on any team, you know, again, using the sports analogy, there's guys on the team or girls on the team that don't play, but they're on the team. And in business, that would be somebody who may not be putting in 60 hours a week, but they're just doing some of the maintenance on the project to make sure that it gets done. That person's important, too, and needs to be included and motivated just to do their job, but there's other people that have to come together, and they have to push the ball forward. You and I both have kids, and we went to school.
Yeah.
It's kind of like, Steve, there's four people in your history class in college. One really does the majority of the work. The second one really helps. The third one, they show up but don't do much. And the fourth one never shows up for their class project.
Right. My son was getting praised at a class. And I said, you should be very proud. The professor signaled you out. They want to do this. He said, Dad, I'm the only one who talks.
Yep. Exactly right.
Listen, man, we'll be off next week. So have a great Thanksgiving. We'll talk to you in a couple weeks.
Happy holidays to you and your family, Steve. Thanks for having me on.
Get it sorted. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch here on 720 WGN, sponsored by Wintrust Chicago's Bank. All right, just over 15 million people, about 10% of the U.S. workforce, is employed in the restaurant industry. And there's a story in the Wall Street Journal about the fact that I think by profession, the restaurant industry leads the way when it comes to addiction. I think they looked at 18 different professions, and they were number one for addiction and number three perhaps for alcohol abuse. Anyway, this the journal writes a story, and they do it sort of with Anthony Bourdain as the lead and looking at mental health issues in the workplace. It's not the workplace, but in the restaurant. And it's not something I had ever considered. It certainly was on the radar of Gretchen van Vlieman, the vice president at StratX, who's been on the show from time to time, and she joins us this afternoon. Gretchen, welcome back to the Biz Lunch.
Thank you for having me.
All right, so StratX, just so we get this clear, you work with personnel issues and staffing for essentially restaurants, right? The restaurant industry.
Right, so like HR consulting for the restaurant hospitality industry.
How big of a problem is this?
It's a huge problem.
Really?
Yeah, you know, besides harassment discrimination, I think the next largest thing that we hear about from an HR perspective is mental health issues and addiction issues.
So when I first came across the article, I thought the idea was that the wait staff who were dealing with abusive customers and things like that, or that was hard that way. But that's not really it, is it? We're talking about in the kitchen.
No. Back of house, in the kitchen. That is a extremely stressful job, a very tough environment to work in and thrive in. The hours are crazy. It's literally hot. It's a tough place to work. Literally. And then also, you know, you don't get a lot of breaks. The competition is fierce in the market, trying to have the next best critical review. So it's always high stress.
It's funny because it sounds to me like everyone is mean to each other back there. But I don't, you know, Gimbel was just on and we were talking about teams.
Sure.
A restaurant is certainly a team in many ways.
Right.
So there'd be celebration and competition maybe.
Exactly. And I don't necessarily know if it's competition within the kitchen sometimes when it comes to like a sous chef or a line cook. But outside. So, you know, how you're only as good as your last Yelp review or write up in the paper. So that's a problem. And if there's some small imperfection in service that night, a lot of times that head chef or that executive chef will lose it. And it's because they are so stressed because they live and die by those reviews.
There's also this school of thought that they went through the abuse when they were coming up, so they can...
Sure.
Which is so old school.
It totally is. And it's a bit of a hazing, you know, suck it up. I went through this. You have to go through it too. It is old school. I think that's changing because you're not able to attract and retain some of the talent that's out there now unless you're treating it more like, not exactly like a corporate workplace, but a little bit more professionally.
Well, and so... Right. There are jobs open, right? So people can move from place to place. But maybe there's less of an escape if this is, we're describing a typical kitchen.
Yeah, I mean, you're going to see some element of this no matter where you go. I think the industry is changing because they have to. And a competitive advantage is definitely retaining and attracting great talent. And with a tight labor market, it's tough to do that unless you're starting to offer some of these programs and change the way things have been done.
Another thing the journal points out, and I'm going to not necessarily read, but to borrow a little bit here. They talk about the big, you know, we all watch the Food Network. We watch
right.
the competition shows, right? So
sure.
in 1998, there were 100 accredited sort of restaurant programs, food culinary programs around the country. Last year, there were 672.
Yeah.
So, you know, 572 more. You've got 39,000 students matriculated from 2 or 4 year culinary degree programs just last year. And there just aren't those jobs out there, right? So now you've got these young people who are investing a lot of money.
A ton of money.
I mean, they're not learning it at the kitchen. They're studying it at the school and they're
right.
graduating with
debt.
Big debt,
yeah.
And they're making, what, if they're lucky, $40,000.
Yeah.
Once they become a cook,
sure.
I think the medium salary, or median is $40,000.
Yeah, I think there's this romanticized view of what this industry can be. And for a few, it is that, but for many, it's not. And to come out of school with that much debt and working at minimum wage, often below minimum wage, hoping for good tips, you know, that's a lot to ask.
All right, so you deal with the employers.
Right.
What's happening? What are they doing?
So I think to combat some of this, there are more benefit programs that they're starting to put in place. So having a good mental health benefit associated with a medical plan, for example, employee assistance programs that offer free 24-hour confidential counseling
right.
for those employees, and also just management training, like teaching a chef how to manage someone the way that they would manage them in a corporate environment.
Yeah, well, we talk about culture and culture change all the time. This is
right.
This isn't an office, one singular. It's a entire sort of industry.
Sure, and then you can't go in there and start expecting to talk to an executive chef the way that you would talk to, a VP at a
right.
white collar real estate investment firm. It's just a very different environment. So you have to take that with a grain of salt. But there's a lot that can be done there to help.
I would imagine too, some bad behavior is almost celebrated in the industry.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of glorified.
Guy? Who's that?
Gordon Ramsay is
sure.
the guy.
Right,
yeah,
right.
He's always cussing and, you know, getting upset. And I think that is very much, you know, probably a characterization of what it used to be. I think it's less than that. In some ways, it's not. But it's glorified. People
okay.
like that.
So we're going to go out for dinner tonight or maybe tomorrow. I'm going to go out tomorrow.
Okay.
And I will pass my compliments on to maybe not the chef. He gets enough. We'll do it to the line cook or
right, right.
the guy washing the dishes.
Or heck, even the server. I mean, that's a tough job too.
Gretchen Van Vlieman is the VP at Stratex. Thanks for coming by.
Thanks for having me.
It's the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN.
Start the timer, because here's the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing and examining Chicago business news of the day. Buckle up, because we're focusing on one big industry today. So if you did some research about what J.B. Pritzker wants to accomplish in his new governor's office, you'll find that legalizing weed is at the top of his list. Why? To help Illinois chip away at its nasty financial problems. Wherever you stand on the debate, at this point, there's not a ton that we can do. Because if the governor-elect wants to pass something that has the support, chances are he's going to do it. So that leaves us in this spot. We should hope for an overwhelming success if this does pass. Thankfully, the governor of Colorado, where weed is legal, was in Chicago earlier this week to shed some light when he said, quote, "The things we most feared, a peak in teenage consumption, a peak in overall consumption, and people driving while high, we haven't seen," end quote. This is a really good indicator as we move forward.
Also, in case you missed it, Michigan recently voted to legalize recreational weed, so there's a good chance that marijuana tourism will develop in Illinois anyway. And I think it's going to catch on, because this right here is a budding industry. I'm Bennett Wakenight, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
The number of the week this week is 87. At the age of 87, novelist and screenwriter William Goldman passed away today in his home in Manhattan. He was the screenwriter for films like Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, All the President's Men, The Stepford Wives, Misery, and more. And he turned two of his own novels into successful screenplays, Marathon Man and my favorite, The Princess Bride. William Goldman, born in Highland Park, passes today at 87.
Bye-bye, boys!
Have fun storming the castle!
Think it'll work?
It would take a miracle.
Bye-bye!
It's 12:53. Here we are on the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WGN. On the phone line now is Laura Adams, the safety analyst at DriversEd.com. Laura, welcome to the Wintrust Business Lunch.
Hey, it's great to be here.
Okay, so tell me true. The Princess Bride is probably one of your favorite all-time movies as well, right? Because it is here.
It's a good one, that's for sure.
That was a good evasion. Okay, tell me about DriversEd.com, because I hadn't heard of it before today, and I'm looking around, and it looks to me like it's a national business where to help kids and others learn to drive, but I wasn't aware it existed. Tell me about it.
DriversEd is the number one online driving school, so we offer courses directly through partners and through some of the largest schools in the country. So as a leader in teaching defensive driving, DriversEd.com is all about education and safety. So we really consider ourselves the go-to resource for all safety-related driving tips, news, and strategies. And so this year, we really want to get out the message of holiday safety, drinking and driving, and really raising awareness of some key issues that can make holidays, you know, a terrible time of year if you're involved in an accident or in a related crash drinking.
I want to talk about that in just a sec. But let's say I live in the South Suburbs here, and I've got a 14-year-old or 15-year-old coming up on driving, and I was trying to figure out a driving school for them to go to. Could I go through DriversEd.com and then find a school, or do you then partner with local schools, or how does that work?
Yeah, absolutely. So I would start at the website at DriversEd.com, put in the zip code or the state where you live, and it will give you all of the courses that are available. So there are kind of a different variety of courses based on where you live, but it's perfect for teen drivers. Not only is there a practice permit test that can help them get their license, a lot of people don't realize 70% of students actually fail their permit test the first time. So having that practice really helps pass on the first try. So online school is there also for older drivers as well.
I'll be going there very soon. Trust me, I believe that. So here we are at the holidays. I think this is, you know, this day actually is a big travel day when it comes to Thanksgiving, even though it's almost a full week away. It is time to be, you know, careful if you're at parties, but also careful if you weren't at parties and you're just driving down the road, right? Extra vigilance at this time of year.
That's right. You know, if you're a great driver, it's really important to realize that many people around you are not. They are distracted. They could have just come from a holiday party and be drinking. There are a lot of dangers this time of year. You've got inclement weather to deal with, you know, rain, sleet, snow. So it's kind of the perfect storm of dangers on the road. So unfortunately, an average of 300 people died in drunk driving crashes just in that week between Christmas and New Year's last year.
Wow.
So it's a really dangerous time of year. December in particular is just one of the, unfortunately, one of the most dangerous times to be on the road. But it's a popular time of year. Obviously, we want to be with our families. We want to, make the commute to see friends and family. So it's important to just think about the time of day. If you can drive earlier in the day, we know many crashes occur at night. So being on the road during the day is a little safer than at night. Also, make sure your car is well-maintained, you know, that you are ready for the winter season. Doing things like, you know, making sure your headlights are on, making sure that you've got all kinds of safety, kits and blankets and those sorts of things in the car when you're driving in cold weather. Just be prepared to be on the road. Be prepared to be in a traffic jam or even for a car breakdown.
Laura Adams is the safety analyst at DriversEd.com. Great to talk to you today, Laura. I appreciate it. Have a great holiday season.
You too. Thanks a lot.